We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Greg Abbott is defying the Supreme Court and continuing to put up razor wire at the Texas border. We have such a great show for you today. The New Republic's Greg Sargent stops by to talk to us about how the media is covering the 2024 election and its many, many failures. Then we'll talk to Semaphore's Dave Weigel about what's happening on the ground in New Hampshire and Iowa and soon South Carolina. But first, we have NBC's national affairs correspondent, John Heilman. Welcome back to Fast Politics, John Heilman.
Hi, Molly Jongfast. It's so great to be here with you again in the wake of, well, I guess what everybody thinks is like the end of the Republican nominating contest. I guess, you know, that's probably the sensible point of view about it. So, you know, how are you feeling about the notion that Donald Trump is now the de facto nominee of the party and is saying that if anybody write the check to Nikki Haley, they're going to be like put in a concentration camp or something?
By the way, where I live in Manhattan, I know so many people who are like, come to me and they say, Mom, you know, I'm giving Nikki Haley some incredible amount of money. And I say, the math is not mathing. There's no world in which this works. And they say, yeah, but something could happen.
Well, they're not wrong. I mean, something could happen. The thing that this has reminded me of in the last couple of days is both 2008 and the 2016 Democratic nomination fights, where after Super Tuesday, David Plouffe like looked at all of the spreadsheets and was like, in a world of proportional allocation of delegates, there's no world in which Hillary Clinton can now come back. And they started making this argument about the math. They would try to convince reporters. They were pretty good. They were good at it. And they were right. I mean, it was like, you know, they would say she would have to win, you know, the remaining contest 65-35, and there's no record of her winning anything 65-35. And so there's no world in which she's going to win all the contests. And there's no math that makes sense. And the Clintons, who are widely described as deluded at this point, were always kind of like, well, something could happen, you know. They could find the whitey tape with Michelle Obama trashing white people. They could find something that will destroy Barack Obama. And you'd be like, well, you guys are out of your mind. And then in 2016, if you want to turn this around for different ideological purposes, it's like there was a moment that came where Bernie, in the last couple months of that campaign, I had conversations with him about it. I'd say, you know, you would have to win 75% of the popular vote in the remaining races to be able to come into the convention with the same number of delegates as Hillary Clinton or more. You know, what are you doing? His answer was really, I'm leading a movement and I can't let go. And I'm saying he didn't say that quite that way, but that was the truth of the thing. And his advisors were like, we're trying to accumulate delegates so we have leverage at the convention. people find various reasons to go on. And I think as deluded as the Clintons were that they were going to find some devastating piece of new information that was going to make Barack Obama unelectable or completely disqualify him. You know, it's Donald Trump. If you're around Nikki Haley and you have the money to go on, because as you know well, no one quits a presidential race because they're losing. They quit a presidential race because the money dries up. If you have the money, and we'll see whether that continues to be the case for her, if you have the money and you're headed to your home state, and you know, people can tell you all day long about how the party down there is MAGA, there's some Republicans and all the demographics, the math's definitely against her. Donald Trump is the all but certain nominee, but it's Donald Trump, right? He's got legal problems. He's got all of these things that are
91 counts.
Yes. And he's got and some of these trials, you know, potentially will start, at least potentially will begin, not end. Well, in this period, is there a chance, given the way the chaotic, hectic, shambolic, crazy ass way that Donald Trump's public life has unfolded, is there a chance that something could happen that would break the race open in a certain way? There's a chance. And it, to me, it's sort of like nobody should be like, yeah, I think Nikki Haley's really got a shot. That's not really the point. The point more is that like, it's clear she's in his head. That thing on Tuesday night, we talked about it on TV on Wednesday morning, but I was at her, not a concession speech, not a victory speech. I'm going to stay in the race speech up in Concord on Tuesday night. And she was better in that speech than I think I may have ever seen her in terms of her projection of confidence, ease in herself, sense of life. She did not seem like a candidate who was trying to put on a brave face. She read to me like a candidate who was like, I've kind of found my groove here. I'm not probably in denial about the ultimate likely outcome here. But as long as she's got someone who's willing to give her money, and as long as she's got the guts, and I do say guts, to risk a loss in her home state that could really leave a mark on her politically forever. As long as she's got those two things, you know, why not? 4 years ago, Joe Biden gave basically that same speech on the night of New Hampshire. He finished fourth in Iowa, fifth in New Hampshire. And he said, there's only two states that have voted. Let the country speak. Why do we have to shut this down right now? I'm going to go on and I want to take this to bigger, more diverse states. I just don't see why, if you thought that was okay for Joe Biden to take that posture, why you wouldn't think it was okay. Nikki Haley wants to, she has the money and she's willing to take the risk. Why would anybody not want to see her out there prosecuting some case against Donald Trump, if those things are true, and only these two little small states have voted?
Yes. And I think that's right. And I think that it's a really good point. And I happen to have written a piece on the Washington Post opinion page that was published quite largely that said that Joe Biden should drop out. Because he wasn't going to win. Probably one of the wrongest I have ever been in my political career. I think that you have a really good point. Now, devil's advocate is that for the last 8 years, we have all sort of engaged in group hallucination that something might happen to Donald Trump.
But this is why I say, let us not engage. I'm the last person to engage in wish casting, and I'm not like some big Nikki Haley fan. I'm not sitting here saying she should stay in because she has a good chance, or she should stay in because she has a reasonable chance. I think she has virtually no chance that in the end, there's some harm in her going forward if that's the choice she wants to make. I kind of applaud her for wanting to stay in and make, again, some sort of case against someone who, you know, is all the things that we know Donald Trump is. And I know a lot of people, you know, who would have said to me in the last, and maybe this would be a controversial point of view, but Democrats who really want to stop Donald Trump, who said, I don't know how I should feel about Nikki Haley because I think, and this is their assertions, a lot of people feel this way, I think she would be tougher for Joe Biden to beat than Trump will be. But I also know that if like Trump's the nominee, there's something around a 50-50 chance that he'll be the next president. And so I don't know what to do about this. Nikki Haley would be too conservative for my taste as president. She might be better suited to beat Biden. Do I really want to take that risk? How should I play this if I'm playing it just in terms of game theory? And my thing is like, if you're one of these people, and I put myself in this camp for sure, I guess speaking as someone who's never cast a vote in a presidential election, but as someone who's covered them, I do put myself in the camp of, I'm on team democracy, right? And if you're one of these people who walks around saying Donald Trump is an existential threat to American democracy, including on the Biden campaign, like what's your real principled argument in which you'd say Nikki Haley should drop out because what? If the argument is, you know, this is an existential threat to democracy, Donald Trump, why shouldn't anybody who's trying to take the fight to Donald Trump, who's not just another autocrat, which I don't think anybody thinks they hate Nikki Haley is, you might think she's too conservative, but no one thinks she's like Mrs. Hitler. It's like, why are you not for anybody who's like leaving it all in the field and trying to keep Cito Mussolini from retaking power. But don't get that confused with thinking, oh, she's got a chance. You know, it's like, if she's got a good chance, like, let's put all of our eggs in the Nikki Haley basket. She's most likely to get creamed in South Carolina if she lasts even that long. The numbers would say she'll probably get beaten pretty soundly in her home state. And then it will then, I think, probably be over because the money will dry up and she probably will be too humiliated to go forward. But why not spend one more month here and sort of see how it plays out in terms of her attraction she gets and what might happen to him. And again, not like kind of wish upon a star, but just like, hey, like, what's the downside? That's my feeling about it. And I will say one last thing about the difference between the Biden thing. The one thing the Biden people will tell you, and I have to give them, just say it out loud. They would say, well, even though Joe Biden had come fourth in Iowa and come fifth in New Hampshire, there was a path for us even then that doesn't exist for her in the data, which was to say, they were like, we had always been in the number one or number two position in South Carolina because we had a kind of popularity with Black voters, which is the key constituency of the Democratic Party. We didn't know whether that would collapse after Iowa and New Hampshire, but we had a path in a way, a theoretical path in a way that Nikki Haley does not right now. And that's true. But again, that was not his public argument was, why are you trying to shut down democracy? We've only had these two small states voted. Let's hear from some more people. And I think if you basically buy that, you know, you got to kind of apply it both to Haley and to Biden in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, Nikki Haley is serving the same purpose that George Conway is and that E. Jean Carroll is, right? They're driving Donald Trump crazy.
Yes. And if you believe, if you look at all this data that we've seen now out of Iowa and New Hampshire, which is people are finding different ways and angles into it. I'm with Joe Scarborough on the, you know, if Barack Obama ran the Iowa caucuses in 2016 after he was on his way out of the presidency, if he ran the Iowa caucuses a third time as an incumbent, quasi-incumbent. If he came back now, you know, he'd get 90% of the Democratic vote. It is striking that Trump is kind of just a little over 50 with the voting electorates that he's had. There is a lot of those people who voted against him, Republicans who voted against him, although in New Hampshire, there's only 25% of them who did. A lot of those people will end up going voting for him in the general election, but not all. And to the extent that Nikki Haley is out there publicly in front of Republican audiences, on Republican media, in other places, highlighting his increasingly addled mental state, his increasingly obvious unsuitability, unfitness, inability to just mentally handle the job. Again, if you think he's an existential threat to democracy, she's going to have a big public platform for the next month or however long she stays in. If she changes five Republican voters' minds over the course of the next month, from my point of view, she's making an important argument.
Dayenu.
Yes, Dayenu. Exactly right.
This was, I thought, a little bit shitty of her. There were so many Democrats and also never Trump Republicans, or not Democrats, but New Hampshire is a state with a lot of undeclared voters. A lot of those undeclared voters voted for her, maybe not so much because they loved her, but because they saw Trump as an existential threat to democracy, as we all do. And she then was sort of not, you know, so grateful for it. But I do think that makes your point.
What is when you say she was not grateful for it, what do you mean by that? I'm not challenging you. I'm just asking, what are you keying off of there?
She said something to the effect of something negative about Democrats in the state. And I can't remember exactly what it was. There were people who really went out of their way and maybe they didn't vote for her as much as they voted against Trump.
Right. I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but I will say this. You know, politics, as they say, Polly, as you know, is not beanbag. And if you are Nikki Haley and you wake up the day after the New Hampshire primary and you see that Donald Trump has beaten you among Republicans by 50 points, and you know that any chance was a 1% chance, infinitesimal chance to beat Donald Trump and to go deep into the primaries against him, because that number has to change. Most of these primaries coming forward are just Republicans. And if you get beat 75-25, in other states among Republicans, I mean, you really are look like kind of a moron to go forward. So if your fundamental political imperative going forward is how do I get more Republicans to vote for me? There is some political logic, even though it seems a little ungrateful and maybe even more than a little ungrateful, but there is some political logic in trying to basically try to project the notion, not that you're like shitting on Democrats who voted for you, who decided to come out to the primary, but that like, you can't allow yourself to be cast in the minds of South Carolina Republicans as the candidate of never Trump Democrats in New Hampshire, right? And so the idea that you have some imperative to rhetorically put some distance between yourself and those people who supported you, I understand that. I mean, again, she could do it in a shittier way or a less shitty way, but I at least understand why she feels like she needs to not basically wear the mantle of, you know, she can't walk out of New Hampshire with a big giant blue overcoat on. You know, it's like, you know, with a big D on the back. That's not going to help her in her cause of beating Donald Trump.
It is interesting to me, though, that Donald Trump is threatening to blacklist MAGA donors who donate to Nikki Haley. I mean, this is a guy who really needs money, and a lot of it he needs for his legal challenges.
Tim Miller and I did this interview with Ann on the last episode of Circus of the Vault. You know, out in Las Vegas, where he did this about Carrie Lake. This all turned into a whole thing. Where Bannon basically said, really said, believing that enunciating the view that the 2020 election was stolen is now a necessity, a litmus test for being in the MAGA movement, right? He was like, if you don't believe that, if you want to test that publicly, you're out, right? I tried to get Carrie Lake to say on camera, I just kept asking her, we had a fight on camera about this. I was like, will you just say what Steve Bannon says? Is that your view? If you don't believe the 2020 election was stolen, you're not a member in good standing of the MAGA movement / Republican Party. And she, because she has some sense of like what she's going to need to do if she's going to be a successful candidate in Arizona, would not go that far. And the reason I raise that whole thing is that there's a flavor of this in a lot of things that are coming out of them now, whether it's the things that Marjorie Taylor Greene said on stage on Tuesday, or this Trump thing about the donors, which is the purity test, the litmus test. And we are the opposite of Big Ten Republicanism. We are not interested in broadening the coalition or welcoming Republicans who are on the fence, Republicans who are for somebody else. We're for, like, if you're not in the cult, and not just in the cult, but like, you know, someone who is like the scout ranking. So like, you know, there's like Boy Scout, you know, but if you're not like an Eagle, if you don't wear like an Eagle Scout pin of MAGA, you know, we don't want any part of you. In fact, we're going to read you out of the party. There's part of that that you look at and you go, that is worrying and dangerous and symptomatic of a kind of fascist impulse and of a cult impulse. And also, the way I look at it is, it's just like politically self-defeating because, you know, in 2020, Trump and his team surprised us all. Because we analysts, pundits, whatever, we would often point out that between 2017 and 2020, Trump had done nothing to expand his coalition. And we're like, how is he ever going to win against the 2020 Democratic nominee if he's brought no one in? Nobody who didn't vote for him in 2016. And they would say, that's not where we're going to get our votes. We're going to get our votes from people who are MAGA, just didn't vote in 2016. We're going to go out and find the voters who didn't. We're going to turn those people out. And a lot of us were skeptical, and we were wrong. They found a lot of those people. Millions,
right,
in fact.
Right.
But that is a population now that I don't think there's anybody in Trump's world. It is in his increasingly actual, real, sophisticated campaign. I don't think anybody would say that there's a lot of untapped from that vote total in 2020, that there's a ton, millions more of Trump voters who didn't vote for him in 16 and didn't vote for him in 20, which means that if you're going to beat Biden, you're going to have to get some of voters, not necessarily from the middle, but certainly like some of these mainstream Republican voters who Trump is now saying, if you write a check to Nikki Haley, you're out, you know, we're going to send you off to an internment camp. I just think like, that's not the way to win. It strikes me as letting your cultish and authoritarian and autocratic and fascistic kind of impulses overcome self-interest in terms of putting together the vote totals they're going to need in these battleground states to actually beat Biden. Although, you know, someone who is being really conspiratorial could say it doesn't really matter because they're just going to try to steal the election by force anyway. But I think he's painting himself into a corner. Both your point, which is he needs the money, that's true. He also needs the votes, and neither one of those things is served by reading the Riot Act, reading, you know, by expelling, expunging, purging anybody who dares to utter a word of support for bird brain. I'm being sarcastic when I say that, bird brain Nikki Haley, or what does he call her dad, Nimbra?
Yeah, he's back and forth between the two.
I liked what he had, like, he couldn't really get Nimrata out, so he went for like a slightly more vaguely, I'm not sure how, but slightly more vague racist thing, which is the Nimbra thing. And he says, oh, Nimbra, that's the name I like to call her. I'm like, you know, I think about the Talking Heads song, I Zimbra. I don't know. It's just weird.
Thank you so much, John. I hope you'll come back.
Always, always. To the extent that I'm physically able, I'm always at your service.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Greg Sargent is a reporter at The New Republic. Welcome back to Fast Politics, my buddy, Greg Sargent.
Hey, how's it going?
We're delighted to have you here, but also excited because you have a new home. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I left the Washington Post after 15 years there, and it was really a great ride. But now I'm at the New Republic, and I'm really psyched because it's edited by Mike Tomasky, who's an old friend of mine and is a brilliant guy and a great writer and editor. And we are going to have a daily podcast at the New Republic. And I really hope your listeners will tune in and check it out.
Yeah, we are big fans of the New Republic here and also of Mike Tomasky. So let's talk for a minute about this was the week of New Hampshire. Joe Biden, I want to pause for a moment and remind everyone of what happened last year, which is like a million years ago. Biden decided not to have the Democratic Party start its primary process in New Hampshire, a high stakes gamble, really, because it meant that Biden was actually not on the New Hampshire ballot. Can we talk about that?
Well, I mean, it obviously worked out just fine. I think the big news on the Democratic side out of last night is that the primary is a big nothing burger. I mean, don't you think that?
Oh, yeah. What I think is really interesting about it was, so Biden had made a promise to Representative Clyburn of South Carolina. And also, I would add, to the Democratic base, which has been really saved by Black women and also people of color more generally. New Hampshire's a very white state. And he had said, we're going to make South Carolina go first. And New Hampshire was basically like, fuck you, we're going to go first and you're not going to be on the ballot. You know, there was a potential for disaster here. And in fact, the people who were hoping that there would be disaster were Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson, went to New Hampshire and decided that they were going to take advantage of this opportunity. And they spent, you know, the last 2 weeks in New Hampshire eating waffles, talking to the press, and it didn't work out for them at all.
We often, as people who are obsessed to a very profound pathological fault with the details of politics, we often sort of admit to ourselves that regular people are not paying attention to the details the way we are. Here's a place where that's really true. Like, if you think anyone out there who's normal, unlike us, gives a shit about primary schedules, you are wrong. Nobody cares about that stuff.
So Biden got about 67% of the vote. He was the write-in candidate. So that is, like, pretty unbelievably spectacular.
Yeah, by the way, there's another thing here, right, which I think we often get wrong. By we, I mean the kind of collective commentariat or whatever. We constantly look at this or that poll that seems to show dissension among Democrats, right? But the bottom line is Biden is pretty popular with the Democratic base. This is a hard thing for a lot of pundits to admit, but it's just the truth.
Right. And in fact, during the New Hampshire primary, there was a lot of punditry on CNN. I'm just going to call it what it is, that said that no one wants Biden and that these two 80-year-olds are both as unpopular as each other, which, again, is like, it really is ultimately media malpractice to compare a guy with 91 criminal counts to a guy who has, like, brought manufacturing back and is building chips. They might both be old, but that's where it ends. And I thought it was interesting. I'm just going to read you this one tweet, which I think from Kyle Griffin, who's a producer at MSNBC. President Biden is on track to win more votes in New Hampshire as a write-in candidate than Barack Obama did when he ran for re-election in 2012. And Obama ran unopposed and was on the ballot there.
Wow. Yeah, you see, there you go, right? I want to say that I think the media worm is turning a little bit.
Yeah, explain.
So, as you say, there was all this kind of media obsessing about how there's some sort of equivalence between Trump and Biden in the sense that, oh, they're both old, they're both despised. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little. That wasn't quite what the press said, but it was almost that. But the real truth of the matter is that what we're really seeing in these primaries is that Republicans are the party with the problem. And the playbook actually got at this today, and they're kind of an arbiter of media. I think that reporters and commentators really pay close attention to what playbook and Punchbowl and all those news source sheets say. And they said the story out of the exit polls is that Republicans are the party that's divided and suffering from dissension. I mean, look, it's actually starting to dawn on people that a fairly non-trivial swath of Republican and GOP-leaning independent voters actually thinks it's a problem to have a criminal as the nominee, right? Which you would think that people would have figured that one out earlier. But there's just this weird built-in tendency in our discourse, which just kind of treats Trump as invincible. Everything makes him stronger. He's using the trials to reach voters. He's owning us all with all these clever maneuvers. He's got us all completely baffled at his continued iron grip on the party, that sort of stuff. And it's smoke and mirrors, a lot of it. We're going to be talking a lot like this on the podcast, by the way. A lot of media.
Yes, on the New Republic podcast with Greg Sargent. No, I think that's a really good point. And the thing that I am just completely struck by is, yeah, Trump has this power. But also Trump, you know, the mainstream media is just obsessed with letting Trump get away with it.
You had a great piece on that recently.
Oh, thank you.
About the press just really not being up to this moment.
It's so depressing. I mean, I have to say there's nothing that there is literally absolutely nothing about it that doesn't just make me so upset. So let's talk for a minute about what the Republican primary looks like. There was a lot of excitement about Nikki Haley. I, as a person who live in New York City and am surrounded by people who are tax cut enthusiasts, had this moment where they were like, Nikki Haley is going to be our savior. And I was like, you guys, the math is not mathing. So Nikki Haley came in third in Iowa. She came in second in New Hampshire. And Donald Trump, got to give it to him. He had a good point. She didn't come in second. She came in last.
Right. Although I do think her showing was significantly stronger than Trump himself expected it to be. And that mattered. I mean, he was yet again melting down about it in spectacular fashion.
For sure. He was absolutely melting down about it. And the polls were wrong again, right? Like the polls showed that she was losing by 50 points and she lost by whatever.
Such an important point that the polls got that wrong. They're getting it wrong on Trump's strength.
Yeah. And again, this is another important point, though, I did think about last night, which was you had a lot of independents and some Democrats switch parties and switch back. Right. You can switch parties. There are a lot of unaffiliated voters in New Hampshire, and a lot of them really came in to stop Trump. And that was their goal. And those voters switched. And then Nikki Haley was, you know, came after them, which I thought was an odd move.
Yeah, and there's something else about the independent vote that I think is really important to underscore, which is that the exit polls in New Hampshire showed that nearly half of voters in the GOP primary, now this is loaded up with independents, and maybe even others, but that's important, right? Because nearly half of the voters in the GOP primary said that if Trump is convicted of a crime, he'll be unfit to serve. Nearly half. And there's a number that I still think of as extremely important from the recent Washington Post poll.
These are from the exit polls. I want to add that exit polling tends to be a little more accurate than calling people on the phone.
Right. It's really important that nearly half of GOP primary voters said that they'd see Trump as unfit if he's convicted. And by the way, what I was going to say is the Washington Post poll, the most recent one, had 57% of independents nationally saying that they believe the prosecutions of Trump are lawful as opposed to political. And 58% of independents nationally said that they believe Trump probably or definitely committed crimes related to January 6th. Now, this dynamic's going to get worse. We could have the January 6th trial. A jury just found that he had sexually abused E. Jean Carroll. These things are going to deepen as problems for him. And I really am glad to see that the press is finally starting to pick this up.
One of the things that I think is an interesting dynamic here, too, is that Trump, the candidate, actually, I think, is going to get very soon into conflict with Trump, the defendant.
Yes.
He wants to go into all these court cases and argue politically because he thinks it will help him, which is certainly possible, but it really will hurt him with voters. I mean, that's what these polls are saying.
That's absolutely right. And it's true, as you say, that it can help him in a narrow sense, right? It's clear that the indictments helped him in the primaries, right? They helped him outflank DeSantis because DeSantis wasn't perceived as, I don't know, a victim of the deep state, a sufficiently victimized figure for the Republican base to support him. But look, I mean, when Elise Stefanik recently described the January 6th prisoners as quote unquote hostages, a number of vulnerable House Republicans actually ran away from that comment, and they went out there and they forcefully stressed that these are not hostages, they are criminal defendants. But what I take from that is that in tough districts across the country, it's toxic for a Republican to be aligned with the MAGA position that the prosecution of January 6th attackers is illegitimate.
And this gets back to this idea that I feel like we should all as pundits get tattooed onto our foreheads, which is this idea that As we have seen again and again and again, Trumpism wins a primary and loses a general. And we saw that with Carrie Lake. We saw that in Pennsylvania. You know, yes, in states, in ruby red states, but even in Ohio, J.D. Vance ran about 10 points behind what he should have.
Yeah, I think it's 100% right. I mean, in 2022, the big story of that election was that the MAGA candidates lost a lot of winnable races. I mean, everything about the fundamentals tilted towards a Republican victory. And again, as you say, the punditry was in denial about this. Remember, and I actually committed a mistake on this too, I think. I actually didn't expect democracy to matter quite as much as it did to voters. And in a very pleasant surprise, and I think the January 6th hearings, by the way, played a major role in this, and Liz Cheney played a major role in it too, especially with independent voters, right?
Yes.
It turned out that the 1-2 punch of Dobbs and January 6th really resulted in kind of a toxic combo for the more MAGA-oriented candidates. In one statewide race after another, they lost.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just amazing to me that this isn't more part of the dialogue. I have this term 2016 brain that I think is really like a syndrome that a lot of people are suffering from. As if the only national election in the last 7 years or so, it's 8 years, that mattered is the 2016 election. We had three national elections since then, and Republicans, especially MAGA candidates and Trump, lost them all or dramatically underperformed in them, as in 2022, which is a bit of a mixed verdict, but basically a Democratic win, right? It's not part of the discussion. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, I think it's really a good point. The problem for a lot of us in pundit world, but also like just in the world itself, is that 2016 came so out of left field. And as I was talking to Brian Kloss about this, is that 2016 was a shifting electorate that shifted, right, for Donald Trump. And now we are in a, you know, we haven't really come back. Again, we don't know, right? We don't know what the shifting electorate will shift for this time. But if you look at Iowa, had this very low turnout. New Hampshire had a much higher turnout. But you have to wonder how much of that was much higher turnout, much closer margins again. So you clearly see that in New Hampshire, they were certainly polling with the 2016 electorate in mind, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, and it's true, as you say, that there was a legitimate reason to be shocked and disoriented by 2016, right?
Yeah.
And look, of course Trump can win this time, right? There are a lot of scenarios you can imagine in which Trump pulls out a victory in the end here. But one can acknowledge that without sort of erasing the last three national elections from the discussion, right? The bottom line is that there is an anti-MAGA majority out there that just keeps showing up. And the special elections, I think, we've all heard the reasons why the special elections aren't all that predictive. But boy, there's a lot of special election wins for Democrats piling up right now. And that is pretty consistent with the idea that anti-MAGA majority is durable.
Right. And I think that's a really, really, really good point. Again, this is this idea that some of the pre-existing mechanisms for covering political races really don't serve democracy.
Yeah, the conventions of political reporting still haven't caught up with the problem, I guess, is one way to put it. I mean, you've written about that.
Yeah, and you've written about it too. So much of the framing here is about comparison. And by comparing these two candidates, you're actually normalizing autocracy.
Yeah, and I think there's also a built-in bias on it's funny, it's kind of ironic that it results in a media bias. And this goes back to what you were saying about sort of the 2016 shock, right? Post 2016 traumatic stress disorder or something, maybe that.
Yes.
Right? That people are still suffering from. I mean, if you think about it, right? A lot of reporters and commentators say to themselves, the one thing they dread most is to miss a big story, right?
Yeah.
And so the feeling was, oh my God, we missed this groundswell of right-wing populist support. And now there's like a bias in the other direction, this constant hunt for signs that kind of right-wing populist swell that upsurge is a real and formidable force, or maybe is more formidable than it really is. And so, again, what gets erased are the examples of all those candidates losing.
Exactly. Greg Sargent, please come back.
Hey, you have to come on our pod.
Dave Weigel is a reporter at Semaphore.
Welcome to Fast Politics. I'm so happy to have you, Dave.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Where are you?
I am in Washington, D.C., getting ready for the June primary. No, I always expected to come back here after New Hampshire had voted. This was the earliest call I can recall in New Hampshire. That's good writing. I was in Nikki Haley's victory party, and she walked out at 8:19, and the polls had closed 19 minutes earlier to give her, I guess you have to call it a concession speech factually, but it wasn't really that. So I got back here right away.
So I think of you, Dave, as the guy who is everywhere. Like, when something happens, I think of you as someone who goes everywhere. And that is a high compliment from someone like me who has my own weird phobias about going anywhere. So you were in New Hampshire on the ground. So what I'm hoping you can tell us is there was a huge turnout in New Hampshire, numbers much bigger than in Iowa, where there was about a 70,000 people less turnout. Besides the weather, why was there that big difference? And can you extrapolate anything from it?
I was surprised that turnout was that high, and I shouldn't have been. The Secretary of State, this is his first cycle, but he's been working in the office for a while. He predicted record high turnout for Republican primary. He predicted low turnout, actually undersold what turnout would look like for Democrats. It's about 20,000 more people showed up in that primary than he thought. I was only surprised because on the ground, there was not the sort of surging enthusiasm that you've seen before competitive New Hampshire primaries. And polling, especially the one tracking poll from Suffolk and the Boston Globe, was showing a Trump blowout, which it kind of was. I mean, there are not many 15-point, or I think in the end it's going to be about 12-point results that you don't think are a blowout. They're probably showing 20 points. I think two things happened. One, the weather was pretty good, literally 60 degrees warmer than Iowa in New Hampshire on election day. It started to snow, but only after voting was done. Not that that's an impediment to people in New Hampshire. So that helped. I think some unlikely voters turned out. And there were a lot of people who did not show up to political events, were never going to show up to Nikki Haley rally in person, but who voted for her just because they wanted to slow Trump down. So a combination of Trump having a very good turnout machine, Haley having a very decent turnout machine between her and America's Prosperity, and just these unlikely voters who said, screw it, I'm going to drive 5 minutes to the school, walk into the polls, take 30 seconds and vote against Trump by voting for her.
So that's what I actually wanted to ask you, because I had dinner on Sunday night with a political scientist based in the UK, and we were talking about the shifting electorate and why some of the reason that polling has become so hard, besides the fact that nobody has phones, is because Trump won on this electorate that did not exist before Trump and has not really existed after Trump, except in 2020, sort of. And so I'm wondering if what we can get about that shifting electorate when we look at, because Iowa is white and tends to be more religious. And notice how I didn't say evangelical, because I feel like it's used in a sort of pejorative there, though evangelicals tend to support Trump, so do with that what you will. In New Hampshire, it's more of a mix. So that sort of Trump voter, that low-frequency voter, probably would show up more in Iowa than in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Actually, one side note, I'm not sure how it fits completely in, but there was a special election to replace a Democrat in a Democratic seat in New Hampshire, and Republicans won it because of the high turnout. And I guess I bring that up because the atypical voter turning out for a very special election has been a college-educated moderate who doesn't like Trump and MAGA. And so Trump changed the electorate in two ways. Most importantly, he converted a lot of white voters without college degrees, which there are fewer in New Hampshire than there are in Iowa, but a lot, converted them to MAGA voters. And he alienated college-educated white voters who were voting for Romney a few years ago and have turned around, don't like this version of the Republican Party. They're going to vote for Chris Sununu, not anymore because he's retiring. They don't like Republicans, and they turn out in everything. The reason Democrats have been doing so well in special elections, they actually flipped a seat in Florida right before DeSantis dropped out, is those voters, they are aware of when elections are. They don't need a lot of cajoling to turn out. They want to vote against MAGA for many reasons, from Trump personally to abortion rights to the uncouthness they see. I mean, these are people who drive past a neighbor who has a Trump flag with the F word on it and say, all right, that's not me. I'm going to vote for whoever else is running against him. That's how he changed things. You saw this in Haley did best in both Iowa and in New Hampshire in places with lots of those voters. She did better in New Hampshire because more of them turned out. It's a little bit easier to turn out. You know, remember to vote in Iowa. In Iowa, you need to show up at the Republican caucuses at 6:30 and change your registration to Republican. In New Hampshire, if you're a undeclared voter, of which there are about 350,000, you're already registered to vote. You just show up and say, I'm pulling a Republican ballot, and then you leave. And so it was easier to do that. A lot of those voters turned out. You can see that in places like Hanover, where Dartmouth is, and places like Durham, where the University of New Hampshire, Concord, places where there are concentrations of college-educated voters who do not like Donald Trump. She did very well, and also very high Democratic turnout. There were lots of Democrats showing up to write in Joe Biden. Those are voters who might have skipped in the past, but Trump activates them. And you were seeing, if you were watching TV, which from it, my favorite polling was by CNN and University of New Hampshire, which said where people's media sources were from. If you watched local news or listened to New Hampshire Public Radio or CNN, you were voting for Nikki Haley. If you watch conservative media, you're voting for somebody else. But all those New Hampshire Public Radio folks, they were very aware of the primary and they were hearing about Trump all the time. And they said, nope, not that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And then there was Biden. Now, let me ask you a question here. We try really hard not to talk about international stuff here, but some people did write in ceasefire.
Not that many. So there was a campaign that formulated, you're right, but and I wrote about it. So I'm saying, how dare I pay attention?
I didn't know the numbers on it. So I'm curious.
It is still being tabulated. It's probably going to be less than 2,000 people who did that. There was a campaign formed in really the final week of the election, which is when most people are turning in. Some New Hampshire progressives held a press conference saying, we're going to encourage people to write in this term. There was actually pushback from Democratic Majority for Israel, which has been spending a lot of money on pro-Israel candidates trying to defeat Israel critics, usually in Democratic primaries, protesting that, putting out a letter and saying, you shouldn't do this. That got a little bit of attention. But when I talked to Marion Williams, Cynthia Phillips, they were saying, look, if you do want to change the Biden approach here, you should vote for a candidate who's not Joe Biden and lower his vote total. Increase the denominator and make it look like he's won fewer votes. Biden ends up with around 65% of the vote as a write-in candidate. Ceasefire ends up probably around 2% at peak, and Biden alternatives get the rest. So there is a anti-Biden vote here, but not explicitly vote for ceasefire vote. There's not. Williamson is a pro-ceasefire candidate. You add them together, that is about 6% of the New Hampshire primary electorate. The obvious example here is, let's make it like 1968, where nobody can ignore the opposition to LBJ and the Vietnam War. That's not what happened this time. And I think there are lots of reasons for that.
Yeah, it's a totally different. I mean, American soldiers are not there.
Yeah, that's the reason. You got it.
Yeah. But I do think what's really interesting when we talk about this is like this does in some way. I mean, New Hampshire really does make a case for the strength of Biden, right? He's not on the ballot. You could argue that Biden got support. There was about $70,000 spent in the state. Unless it's more, you might know better than I do, Dave. What I read was about $70,000 to get people going to know that there was a write-in campaign. I still think that's pretty amazing, considering that he had snubbed the state, right? He changed I thought New Hampshire would be madder at him because he has robbed them of their status as going first.
Yeah, that was a surprise. Remember, I was quoting the Secretary of State's projection. It was that maybe 88,000 people would bother showing up for the primary period. And there was a lot of worry, I'd say 3 months ago, that Biden was going to do this. One thing that Governor Sununu would point out a lot is that Democrats didn't have their meeting on their primary schedule until after 2022's midterms. He thought that would be an issue that would help Republicans, and they pushed it back, so they didn't get the bounce from that. But while this primary was happening, some pollsters were asking, okay, when this is over, are you voting for Joe Biden or Donald Trump, or would you vote for Haley or Joe Biden? And Haley was in a close race with Biden up a little. Biden was beating Donald Trump because these voters were less offended. There also was an impression, I think, enhanced by this write-in campaign that, look, we're going to we're going to get the primary back at some point. There's going to be a 2028 primary. Democrats will realize they shouldn't have done this. They're going to come back to it. So that was explicitly an argument made by the write-in effort. It was a grassroots, if you can call Democratic lobbyists grassroots, they are. I mean, they were doing this without money from the campaign. That's Jim Demers and Kathy Sullivan, that's what they were telling me and other people. Yes, if we have a great showing for Biden, the party's going to come back to us. Actually, I just was double checking. It's going to be closer to 125,000 New Hampshire voters who turned out. That is 50% more than the state projected. Biden's going to end up, a stat that you're going to see thrown around is Biden got more votes as a write-in candidate as than Bernie got when he won the 2020 primary.
Or than Obama got, right?
More than Obama got in 2012 when there was no opposition and when Democrats were just going to go back and redominate him. They wanted to prove that. They said, OK, we know you're unhappy, but I should put it this way. The message was, we're not Iowa. We're not the state that screws up the primary that makes you stick around waiting for results. We're not the one that can't count. We are the one where people are engaged and they will show up. You should really reconsider your purge of us, not purge, but you know, your slight demotion of us in 2028. I feel like they succeeded based on the chatter I hear from Democrats.
Oh, interesting.
They're probably going to be revisiting this in 3 years. And if Biden's president and there's a new nomination, they are confident they'll be able to come back and say, you know, we took our lump, but come back and do the best primary, the one everyone loves. So come back and hang out with Vermin Supreme.
I know you've seen this. I just know you've seen this, the CNN interview where they thought they were interviewing a normal New Hampshire voter.
Yes, because Kathy Sullivan, that's one of the, she was leading the super PAC in favor of writing in Biden.
Yes, can you talk? That was one of the great moments ever. So they clearly think they have like a little old lady here. And she is, explain to us who she is again. Because I thought that was great.
Kathy Sullivan is a former New Hampshire Democratic Party chair. She was there when Barack Obama won. So she was there for New Hampshire Democrats becoming not the dominant political party, but the party that wins most of the federal races. Chris Sununu has been able to break that. They're trying to keep that record this year, but they've won governor's races, but they've struggled in Senate and House races since the party shift, since more college-educated white voters became Democrat. And yeah, she ran the super PAC that was paying for signs and mail, not TD ads. You never saw a TD ad that said write in Biden, but you saw a lot of road signs that were explaining how to write it in. She paid for that. Yeah, on CNN, she said that what Dean Phillips is doing was obnoxious.
I did think that was sort of amazing. But Dean Phillips, he made sort of a similar case. I mean, I actually read a really smart essay yesterday about how both Dean Phillips and it was just something I hadn't thought about. Both Dean Phillips and Nikki Haley both ran sort of on the idea that the other guy was too old, right? That on this sort of ageism platform, because Dean Phillips has almost ideologically, he's almost identical to Biden. In fact, he's really, for someone of his age, his beliefs are very center for this Democratic Party. So I'm just wondering, neither of them really did what they said they were going to do or what they had hoped they were going to do. But both of them seem unfazed by their inability to deliver what they said they were. I mean, will they both stay in, do you think?
Phillips is staying in. Williamson is staying in. Phillips in public, including to me, said he needs to get into the 20s, which he did. As the votes are finally being counted, he barely made it into the 20s. That is, it's going to round up to that, at least. He underperformed what he wanted. More quietly, they said, we did the 20s. They really wanted some dramatic result closer to 1968 when LBJ only gets 49% of the vote and Eugene McCarthy gets 41. They didn't get that. Half of Eugene McCarthy is something you'll hear from Biden folks. He has a problem where he is not really relevant in South Carolina, where voting is happening next, thanks to Democratic calendar. He is not on the ballot in Nevada because he got in the race too late to make the ballot. So he doesn't get another test of how popular he is or how popular the idea of replacing Biden with a generic Democrat. This is a joke Andrew Yang likes, is that if you just can convince Dee to change his name to generic Democrat, I'll save the country for Trump. He didn't get another test of that until Michigan at the end of February. And then it's not clear exactly where else he can be. I mean, one story I've worked on by talking to Phillips is that he missed some other deadlines. So Florida, which is mid-March, has a primary that he's not going to be on the ballot for. North Carolina is a Super Tuesday state. He's not on the ballot for that. So he put $5 million of his own money, which is considerable. He's a successful businessman before he became a member of Congress. He's put money in the race. He has a super PAC funding him that has not been that successful. It did really one of the better sidebar stories of this race was the Dean Phillips Super PAC creating an AI version of Dean Phillips that could answer your questions and then shutting it down. It's the Super PAC is funded in part by Bill Ackman, Sam Altman. He's a little bit embarrassed by what the Super PAC is doing, but yeah, there's the money out there to keep funding him.
Wait, Sam Altman?
Yeah, the OpenAI guy is also a Phillips supporter.
Okay. Wow. All right. Good for that's great. Tech bros once again. So now we go to South Carolina. I mean, it just seems as if Donald Trump can't help himself when it comes to Nikki Haley. Do you think that's the dynamic? I mean, and ultimately probably doesn't do much for Nikki, but it might help Biden ultimately, right?
It could. So I am very skeptical of any Trumpist finish because of the way he emotionally reacted to something theory. We have seen this not work too many times. Even Democrats I talk to, if they could program the media, which believe it or not, they don't get to sit in newsrooms and tell me what they're doing. They would love more of a focus on what is he going to do about abortion access, abortion medication? What is he going to do about tax rates? What is he going to do about labor? Because he has conservative advisors who'd want to gut the NLRB, Elon trying to sue it out of existence. They'd love to talk about that because they think Trump being erratic is not really a problem for him. Haley did, to give her credit, get under his skin. Her basic strategy on election night was concede quickly, which she did, which is normal. If you're not Trump, you usually concede the election if you lose, and you do it before the victory speech, and you get to influence a victory speech. So she came out there with a speech where she laid out how she was going to keep running for 2 months. She never said she lost the race. She said, thank you, God. She talked like somebody who had just won an election. And yes, that pissed off Trump, who is going to keep making fun of her. The advantage he has, though, as opposed to 2016, when he actually lost Iowa and then yelled about it, said it was stolen, is that he has a superstructure in the Republican Party agreeing that Donald Trump should be the nominee and she should back off.
Like Ron and McDaniel.
Yes, like the sheriff for the RNC, which I wrote yesterday. You're not supposed to do. It's in the bylaws of the party, Rule 11. You're not allowed to do that. The party's not allowed to give an in-kind contribution before there's a nominee. And they did. So he's already got the party saying, yeah, we agree. Maybe we're going to express it differently than Donald Trump and use prime time on election night to make fun of her. But he is, I think, channeling what his voters think and what a lot of Republicans think. He said that, but also J.D. Vance has said that. The governor of South Carolina is getting there. He is a Trump endorser who is campaigning for him. I don't think that is a harmful thing for Trump to look like he's annoyed at Nikki Haley for not conceding, because so are many of the forces inside the party.
Yeah. And also, I think you had a really good point. Being insane does not necessarily hurt Trump. If anything, it's sort of baked in. This was so interesting. I so appreciate you coming on. And just also, I continue to be grateful for your dispatches from places that I desperately do not want to ever go. Thank you, Dave.
It's great.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jung Fast. Trump, he's yapping. He's in court. What's going on?
You know, he's testifying right now as we are doing this. We have Alina Haba. You may remember Alina Haba as being completely unqualified for this. And she is sparring with Judge Kaplan and also with Roberta Kaplan, Robbie Kaplan, who is the lawyer for E. Jean Carroll, and who, of course, full disclosure, I know him and friendly with all these people.
I saw that in a Truth Social post today, in fact, from Mr. Trump.
Yes, I've been truthed, but I just want to say that Trump is going to have a lot of trouble with his testimony. And already we see Trump saying, she said something I considered a false accusation. Roberta Kaplan, objection! Judge Kaplan, sustained. And Ms. Haba, I have no further questions. Judge Kaplan, cross-examination. There was a trial here, correct? Trump, yes. So this is going to be my moment of fuckery. Basically, they got two questions. Donald Trump was not allowed to do the kind of lying he gets to do everywhere else. And for that, that is my moment of fuckery.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota BZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.